Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 38 of season 10 of Movie Roll Minute, the early podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action crime thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Andy Golding of Blueprint Review and formerly of the Spoiler Podcast. Welcome back to the show for yet another episode, Andy.
Good to be back again, Rob. And I will remind the listeners again right at the top of the show that at some point in the show today, I will be hijacking the podcast by saying the words, "I'm taking your train."
Yeah, you keep scaring me every time you do that. So,
Well, what they can't see at home is that I've got the disguise on from the film and a gun right here, a machine gun.
There you go. Yeah, that mustache really... Keeps you hidden very well. Minute 38 begins with Costello continuing to explain the situation and ends with Warren showing why he's actually the deputy mayor. So we ended things yesterday with Garber getting instructions from the captain, Costello, telling him that he's now in charge and saying that he's on his way to Central Command before everyone else gets there before him. And he started to say, because the city copsil, and he got cut off. And today we finished the rest of it by saying they're going to hog all of the action. So it's just really weird the way that he says that they're going to hog all the action. You know, using the term action for what's going on here. It basically tells us once again that these cops are all really, really bored. Nothing interesting is going on. You know, they got a cantaloupe that they think is a bomb scare, and that's about it. You know.
There's been that trope for a while, hasn't there, in films and TV about various cops of various precincts or various levels. Just not wanting the others to get the action. They want the limelight.
Right. Again, it goes back to what I was saying yesterday, the idea that they want to be able to take the credit and make sure someone else gets the blame.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that works. it's the politics of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, which we're going to be touching on in this minute as well.
Yeah, right. And then he throws out a line and he goes, "There's even one on board the train, one of the hostages." And then we get Garber's face and he goes, "You're kidding. There's a cop on the train? How do you know?" And he goes, "Well, there were two of them, but one got off at 33rd Street and called in later when the news got out. I mean, the other one's still on the damn train." It's actually very interesting because, you know, the train stopped at 33rd Street and then it stopped at 28th Street. So how do they know the guy didn't get off at 28th Street? Or you know, because he didn't call in. That's about it. Unless he said, "I'm on my way to my folks' house on, at the end of the line," or whatever it is, you know, so he was staying on the train. That's about it. And it's also really interesting listening to the fact, like, nowadays, you know, we all have cell phones. We're all constantly reachable and in contact, you know, but this cop had to go out of his way to find a payphone or some sort of way to call it in and say, "By the way, the train that you're talking about that was hijacked, my partner's on there."
Yeah, cell phones have become the bane of thriller writers' lives, haven't they? They have to either find a way to get rid of that cell phone or they have to make it a period piece before cell phones to stop them being in the way of the story.
Yeah, there are a lot of movies that just won't work these days because of that. Did you ever see that? It was on YouTube where someone made a spoof of 24 that took place like in the early 90s, you know, where, because, you know, in 24, one of the big jokes was that everyone was always on cell phones, but here, you know, you had to like dial in, you know, to the internet and, you know, it's quite funny. You know, it makes you realize how things have drastically changed, over the years and stuff like that. There's I'm trying to think if there's like a perfect movie that is it Planes? Yeah, maybe it's Planes, Trains, Automobiles. We were talking about that, when I did that 8 seasons ago. I think that was the movie that we talked about where if they had had a cell phone, it would have just completely changed. None of this would have happened. The whole plot wouldn't have worked, and it actually is because there was talk at the time that they were going to do a remake with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence or something like that. And the big question was, okay, how do you make this movie nowadays when how they don't have cell phones? Because that would negate everything.
Well, if that's the reason that that film never got made, then God bless cell phones, because I do not want to see that remake.
Yeah, I didn't want to see it either. There's no question about that. That's because you don't need to remake a movie that's near perfect. That's what it comes down. But right. So basically, Costello continues and says, and that means the other one's still on the damn train. And then Garber goes, "Plain clothes?" He goes, "Yeah, technical force. Man or woman?" He goes, "You know something? I never even thought to ask." He goes, "Well, it doesn't make any difference, Captain. Whoever it is can't do much single-handedly." Now, I do like the backhanded compliment that Garber gives here because he basically tells us that this cop, whether it's a man or woman, it doesn't really make a difference. There's nothing they can do against four armed men with machine guns.
Yeah,
But
but then later on he does say he does backpedal on that because later on he just say something like, "Well, what can one person do, especially if it's a dame?"
that's right. You're right. But again, that's just the misogynistic way that this movie talks about women at the time.
Well, it's absolutely. I think it's also a good piece of writing for Garber's character because you can't make him. I mean for the time, people would have spoken like that anyway. But you can't make him too progressive. I don't think he would fit into his environment. He's got to have a bit of he works in that context. So he if you make him some kind of really progressive person, he wouldn't last in that job amongst those people, I don't think.
No, of course not. I mean, again, we see how Kaz was talking. He's talking about Mrs. Jenkins, and they how can you run a goddamn railroad without swearing? Like things like that. It's it adds to the characters, and it also adds to the time. Obviously, today people would talk very differently, rightfully or unrightfully. It doesn't really make a difference. The point is that at that time, that was what was acceptable. Okay,
Yeah,
we
well,
can
there's
look at
levels,
it.
isn't there? I mean,
Right.
the fact Garber thinks to ask man or woman, and no one else has thought to even ask. It shows that he is a bit ahead of the curve.
That's correct. Now, do you remember the line that Garber will say later when he meets up with this policeman?
Yes, it's something like I thought you were a taller guy or something like that, isn't it?
No, he says,
Oh, is that
"Don't worry, miss. The medics are on their way."
Oh, I'm thinking of when he meets up with the black police, the black officer.
That's right. With officer with the Daniels, right? Daniels, he says, "I thought you were taller." That's right. I thought you were shorter or something like that. Yeah, no, but I'm talking about the fact that he when he sees the plainclothes officer, the undercover guy, he thinks it's a woman because he has long hair. That's the ironic aspect of it. Because here you have this line where he says it doesn't really make a difference, but then he thinks it's automatically a woman.
It's
So
interesting, yeah.
I like the way that they do that.
What do you think of the cop on the train strand? Because I remember when I first saw it being a bit disappointed when it was revealed. But I think I was watching it as a teenager. I was looking for more of a sort of naive thrill, and so I was expecting it to be the passed out alcoholic woman,
Yeah,
which I
so
think would
that would have
be
been very
too much of
interesting.
a stretch, but
Yes. Who later on will wake up and say, "Did we get to the end of the line?"
yeah.
No, but yeah. I the first time I saw this movie was over 40 years ago, so I can't really tell you what I thought of at the time. You know, whether I was surprised that the hippie was the cop or not.
Yeah.
I don't know. But looking at all of the various characters, I think it's a good choice.
Yeah.
You know, I
Yeah.
like the fact that this is the guy that you would, besides the drunk woman, it probably would be the person who would draw the least amount of attention to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, because the drunk woman, everyone's just sitting and ignore. You know, and
Yeah.
that's the point. You know, that's what you want to do. So, all right, so. He uses the term plain clothes. Do you have any idea where the origin of the use of plain clothes officers began?
Oh no, let's think it. Ooh, plainclothes officers. I'm thinking it wouldn't have been too far ahead. Was it like a 1950s?
Nope, goes back a little further than that. It started
Yeah.
in the 1820s.
Oh, a lot further again. I'm way out. It wasn't quite as bad as last time when I said something like early 1900s and it was the 1500s,
Yeah,
but.
exactly. Okay, so the idea of using plainclothes officers was started in the early 19th century, mostly in London, where they had policemen that would wear ordinary civilian clothes to do covert activities like surveillance and gathering evidence in order to avoid alerting suspects to see, you know, a what are they called? A bobby,
Yeah.
you know, just hanging around, that type of thing. So the idea is to, you know, to help make someone look less conspicuous. It was mostly used in America by the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, where, you know, they started that also in the around that time in the mid 19th century, where the idea was is that again, you can get detectives can get closer to the suspects and the areas that they're surveilling if they you know they don't tip everyone off that they're a cop.
Yeah.
And the term itself was first recorded in 1822, and it refers to the ordinary dress of civil life. So,
Okay.
you know, that makes a lot of sense. So and then the shot changes and we're now back in Gracie Mansion, where we get to see the mayor.
Yay! I love the mayor scenes. I specifically requested to have a mayor scene when you asked me what I was interested in talking about, and here we are.
And it makes sense because he is a perfect person to play this role. There's no question
Yeah.
about that. We talked a little bit about him last week, so we unless there's something specific you wanted to mention about him, there isn't really much that we can go into besides the fact that he does look like Ed Koch, but Ed Koch wasn't he wasn't mayor yet. So
No.
that's even more ironic that just a few years later. You know, he would, you know, th there would be a mayor who looked like Lee Wallace, as
Yeah.
opposed to it working the other way b around.
I know Ed Koch from there was a Oscar-winning claymation short called Sunday in New York, which had him as a claymation singing version of him.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting. Now, you know, he was also, I mean, we talked about this last week. He was also in the original Batman movie, the Tim Burton Batman movie, playing the mayor.
Oh yeah.
So he's not only the mayor of New York, he's also the mayor of Gotham.
Yeah.
So
He's typecast as mayors, and I wonder if you've played any other mayors.
yes, in the movie The Daniel from 1983, he played the mayor.
Oh,
Still being credited three times is
yeah,
pretty good.
three times suggests there's something mayoral about him.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that assessment. So, we talked a little bit last week about the mayor being on the phone with Warren, and now Warren actually comes into the room, and then Al says, "Warren, I thought it was over." He goes, "I know what we're gonna do." He goes, "You tell me. We're gonna let him keep the goddamn subway train. Hell, we got plenty of them. We're not even gonna miss it." And then Warren turns to him and goes, "How about the 18 hostages, Al? We gonna miss them?" He goes, "Warren, God damn it, this city hasn't got $1 million. Well, you better empty out one of your Swiss bank accounts because there's no other way. Don't we even get to think about it? There's no time. All right. I still want the full picture. Get me the police commissioner, the chairman of the transit authority, and that putz we got for our controller." And he goes, "They're on their way over now." So just this little conversation between these two characters says so much about both of them. We see that the mayor is a weasel. No other way to put it. He cares only about himself and about his politics and nothing else, which nowadays things haven't changed much in many places and aspects.
Yeah.
We don't get into politics, but in general, that's probably a safe bet to make
It, I
that.
think it's a recognizable political
Yes.
trope, isn't it, that?
Yes. But the idea that the mayor then says he tells Warren who he wants him to call, and then Warren, ends this minute by saying, "Well, they're already on their way over," meaning that I already know what I need to do. I just came here for your
Freezing
rubber stamp.
control.
I like that.
Exactly, he's in control.
I like the way that he does that. And
They're a
so,
very good double act, I think. Lee Wallace and Tony Roberts.
for sure. For sure. Now, he mentions the idea of that you're going to have to empty out one of your Swiss bank accounts. So, around what time in history did it start becoming popular to keep money in Swiss bank accounts?
Oh dear. Right. How far out can I get it
I don't know.
this time? Swiss bank accounts, maybe the 1920s.
No, it goes all the way back to the 1700s.
Oh dear.
It goes all the way back to the early 1700s when the European upper class would keep stuff in banks in Switzerland. The whole idea of the creation of the Swiss banking system was that they would, the idea of confidentiality and secrecy.
Yeah.
The idea was to protect wealthy European banking interests. And then in 1934, they passed a law in Switzerland called the Federal Act on Banks and Savings Banks, which were used to protect the assets of any people who had Swiss bank accounts, whether you are a Swiss citizen or not. And that actually caused a lot of controversy following World War II, because a lot of the high-ranking Nazis hid things in Swiss bank accounts, and the Swiss would keep their secrets and wouldn't let it out, whose accounts they were holding on to and what was it, and whether they knew what was in them or not is a different story. But they still wouldn't give out the information as to who owned them. So there are bank accounts, here, World War II ended 80 years ago. There are bank accounts that will be never opened because the people who open them are no longer around. whether they were
Yeah.
Nazis or not, it doesn't matter. But that's one of the craziest things about this whole idea.
Yeah.
That everything is completely secret, but what happens when, if someone didn't do anything? It's just sitting there in a bank and nobody knows, even the heirs don't get it or anything like that. So it's very interesting about that whole thing. Many people have used it over the decades to and companies, not just people, to find ways to illegally evade taxes, hide assets, or find other ways to commit other financial crimes by putting stuff in Swiss bank accounts. Now, it's a commonly used trope in movies, that people put stuff in Swiss bank accounts. John Grisham was the first
Yes.
one to go a different way and start talking about the Cayman Islands, which was also a tax shelter. But so in 2017, though, they actually passed a law called the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act with the U.S. And that actually helped a lot of the Swiss banks close accounts held by U.S. citizens or ban U.S. citizens from opening up accounts because of the fact that they then needed to start being able to disclose information. They didn't want to disclose it. And once they signed this act, basically it changed that the secrecy remains in force only for people who are living in and are solely taxable in Switzerland. So that also changes things around a lot with the way that they do
Yeah.
that. Have only been four cases since 1934 where people have broken the secrecy laws. They violated them to a major extent, and there are four people. Again, I've never heard of any of these people. So you have Christoph Miehle in 1997, Bradley Birkenfeld in 2007, Rudolf Elmer in 2011, and Hervé Falciani in 2014. Those are the
No,
only
not heard
three.
of any of them.
Those are the only four cases in the last 90 years where someone has broken, the secrecy. I mean, it sounds like, that people keep that the Swiss keep these things more secret than lawyers, doctors, or priests, who are all
Yeah.
sworn to secrecy also. Yeah, it's just very, very strange the way that they do that. But yeah, so I guess the mayor has a Swiss bank or has numerous bank accounts somewhere that only Warren knows
Yeah.
about.
Yeah. Just another hint that he's a bit of a scumbag.
Exactly. And anyone who's seen the movie knows that he is not going to open up his Swiss bank account for that.
The other detail that I love about the mayor, which tells us this thing of he only cares about himself, is that they have him have a cold, and he just keeps using tissues and then just flinging them across the room like that. He'll make the mess. Someone else will clean that up.
That's right. That's true. And I love the fact that nobody ever says Gesundheit to him. They leave that for Mr. Green. And that's all I have to say about this minute. Did you have anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I don't think so, no. I think we covered that minute.
All right. So every Wednesday, we have a segment called Hijack Hump Day, where my guests will talk about their top five movies featuring hijackings. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, well, initially, I was going to leave Taking a Pelham 123 out of the lists and just take it as read, but as we're scoring points with it, I'm putting it in. So the one that got bumped from my number five position at to number six now is a very, it's kind of a, I wouldn't say it's quite so bad it's good, but it's not a good film necessarily, but it's a very enjoyable one. It's a film called North Sea Hijack, directed by Andrew V. McLaglen, who directed films like Shenandoah and McClintock in the 60s. And it's a strange film and a very funny film. but it's not an outright comedy. It stars Roger Moore, Anthony Perkins, and James Mason, so it's got quite a stacked cast. But Roger Moore was trying to sort of move away from his Bond image, and he plays a bizarre hero character called Rufus Excalibur Foulkes, who loves cats and hates anyone who doesn't like cats. And he's a proudly misogynist character, and he's working to rescue Anthony Perkins has hijacked three oil rigs, and he's planted bombs on these oil rigs, which he will set off if his demands aren't met. It's a lot of fun. It's not a great film, but I wanted to mention it in there. So getting into my actual top five then.
Okay, well, first,
My number
before you go
five.
into that, do you know that that movie is based on a novel which has a really, really interesting title?
Is it? I know the alternative title to the film is Folks, which is the name of Roger Moore. But I don't.
Yes, and it's
What's
also
the
spelled,
novel?
first of all, folks is spelled with two F's.
Oh, I think I know what the
FFOLKS.
title is. Is it the names of the oil rigs?
Yes, it is.
And it's three women's names, isn't it? But I can't
That is
remember what it
correct.
is.
Esther, Ruth, and Jennifer.
That's it. They're the three oil rigs.
Yeah. Now I find that really funny because those are two of those names are my grandmother's names. I have one a grandmother whose name
Oh,
was Esther and the other one was Ruth. So I just find it really funny.
wow.
But yeah.
Okay, my well, number five is Mark Robson's 60s film starring Frank Sinatra, Von Ryan's Express, which features a train hijacking by some prisoners of war. It's just a really enjoyable film. I think I really like that film. Another Express at number four, it's the Sugarland Express, Steven Spielberg's first theatrical release. It tends to get overlooked because of Jewel, but Jewel obviously was the TV movie, and then this was his first official theatrical release. And it's about a cop car gets hijacked there, and along with the cop inside it by Goldie Hawn. I think it's a very overlooked film in the Spielberg canon. Number three is an even more overlooked film, which I love, and it's a little independent film from the 90s, by Alan Taylor, and it's called Palookaville, and it's about a group of sort of small time crooks who are trying to hijack an armored car. It stars Vincent Gallo, and I can't remember who else is in it now. Let me just get Palookaville up, and we'll see.
I've never even heard of that.
It stars Vincent Gallo, William Forsythe, Adam Tress, Lisa Gay Hamilton. It sort of slipped through the cracks. It was interesting because it came out when independent films were really big and when crime films were really big. But it's quite low key, so I think that's why it slipped through the cracks. But Alan Taylor went on to make huge films like Thor: The Dark World and one of the Terminator films. He did Terminator Genesis. He directed as well. But this is where it is for me with Alan Taylor. It's a great little film, Palookaville. So my number two then, I'm putting Taking the Pelham 1-2-3 in as my number two, for obvious reasons. It only gets pipped because the number one is one of my favorite films of all time. It's the Ealing comedy, The Lavender Hill Mob, which I don't think a lot of people will immediately think of as a hijacking film, but it's the hijacking of an armored car in that as well, which
Wait,
sets the plot in motion.
what's the name of the movie?
The Lavender Hill Mob,
Ah, okay.
with Alec Guinness,
Yeah, of course.
directed by Charles Cline.
I just didn't hear you properly when you said it.
All right, I was going to say that's a blind spot for you. I'd be
No, no, no,
surprised.
no, 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 no.
So that's my number one. And before we move on to, I think you can see where I'm going with this. Before we move on to the trivia, I'm taking your train, Rob, because I've done another top five list.
Uh-oh.
This time, I thought we've paid tribute to one of the hijackers, Mr. Blue. We're going to pay tribute to another one now, Earl Hindman. But this isn't a list of Earl Hindman roles because I only know him really from this and Home Improvement.
I was going to say, you want like top five Wilson advice.
Well, what struck me thinking of these two roles is that his face is obscured in both of them.
Correct.
And so I've done a top five list of character of films featuring characters where their faces are obscured. So my number five is Kate Blanchett in Hot Fuzz. She plays in the forensic mask at the beginning. She plays Simon Pegg's girlfriend in that. She's my number five. Number four is Hal Holbrook in All the President's Men. Obviously, he plays Deep Throat in Shadow most of the time. And then more another shadowy figure at number three, William Alland in Citizen Kane, plays the reporter who's looking into the life of Charles Foster Kane, and we never really see his face. Number two, we don't see any of this person because it's Douglas Rain as HAL 9000 in 2001 A Space Odyssey, completely unseen. But my number one had to be one of my favourite actors, Claude Rains in The Invisible Man by James Whale.
Oh, wow. Interesting. That's great.
So that's my hijacking for today.
and you didn't even put Mr. Brown on the list.
No.
Okay, fair enough. All right, and every day we also have a game that we play called Name That Remake, where I will give you a brief synopsis of a movie, give you the year that the original came out and the year that the remake came out, and you have to try and guess what movie we're talking about. So I'm going to spin the wheel and see what movie comes out. And let the wheel spin around and around and around. Okay. So the original movie came out in 1950, and the remake came out in 1993. The idea is that a man trying to get involved in politics hires somebody to teach his girlfriend better etiquette so that she will fit in with high society.
Yes, this is Born Yesterday, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Have you seen both versions of it?
I've only seen the original. I never did see the remake. I really like John Goodman, but I've never seen that film.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the original is from 1950 is with Judy Holliday, William Holden, and Broderick Crawford. And the remake is with John Goodman and Melanie Griffith.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yep. All right. Excellent. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Andy Golding?
Okay, you can find my now defunct podcast, Spoiler, where we review films, books, and TV shows in their entirety, at spoilerpodcast.podbean.com. And you can find my writing on new releases and old classics at blueprintreview.co.uk.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Ramen. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, achoo.
Gesundheit.